get a good short burst of energy underway, and then it becomes very difficult to sustain, because there is no particular Protestant Reformation to sustain it, but certainly we can certainly create something. Government is a most imperfect vehicle for the long term too, but it does need to be done. It is probably going to be the primary responsibility of the people who live in Alaska generation after generation to ensure that a solid group of them try to create that type of moral imperative, which is going to make these things go forward. As Guy Martin pointed out, it is a living law. It has been from the first, and it, as I said in the paper, you have to view it in the context from right now of developing it over the next 50 years, the next two generations. The one thing I didn't mention that I got into in the paper, which I didn't mention in the summation, was the effect of the act on the population patterns of Alaska. I truly believe that one effect of the act is going to be generally to fix the villages in place for a much longer term than they would have been without the act. And the role of the state government is to recognize this and base its policies for the long term, that the villages will be there, whether they are the most efficient place to deliver services in the crudest type of analysis is not really the issue, because both governments have said through the act that the villages will be there in place, and they are that kind of framework on which you can build a future moral imperative that in the future social makeup of Alaska. The I think that looking at Dave Hickok brought up, you know, some of the original Marshall decisions and those things, and I think we have to, you know, really spring forward from everything that is been developed in North America that sprung from those. When I studied constitutional law, Justice Marshall was not one of my favorite sources, because I disagreed with a great deal of what he did and still do. I think that the United States is living with some fundamental mistakes that Justice Marshall made, that we in not only in dealing with American Indians, but and federal-state relationships and everything else. So I think, you know, it's a time to think broadly as far as developing new concepts in this, as the staffers did, who wrote Angstke. I think that nothing I have written I would want to take away from, you know, what the people who we're providing input to that word doing and trying to change federal-state relationships to meet new needs. And Bill Van Ness summed up admirably at the end on that. In Charlie Johnson's remarks on the state-imposed things, state impositions, I think that the state bureaucracy is an absolutely key element in the successful implementation of this act. And because it is close to home and more easily controlled, we have a better chance of making that state bureaucracy an extremely positive force. It is in some areas, but unfortunately not in others. And one of the key groups of people who are going to determine whether the villages as social units, whether the villages as corporations succeed over the long term. So having state bureaucracies which are motivated to do the right thing as we're talking about it here, that carries over from administration to administration, is something that I think that all of us who are concerned with this need to devote a good deal of attention to. I was happy in John Havelock's remarks that he got in some depth into what, you know, the true rights of the landowner have been for the last 50 years, and, you know, extremely complex subject. But I said in the paper, I do not believe that Alaska Natives truly understood what their rights would be as landowners in the new world after ANCSCA. There wasn't particular time to provide the in-depth explanations. The Native leadership certainly didn't have the financial ability to do that job at that time. I regarded it as the role of the state primarily. The state was strapped for resources at that time. It did have enough to do it if it chose to. It just didn't choose to make it a real priority in explaining, you know, how the state was going to handle these new corporations, which were creatures of the state and so forth. And I'd stand by the statement that Alaska Natives did not understand what the change to state sovereignty was going to be in all of its aspects. The other points that John made, and it hasn't been Anglo-Saxon land tenure for half a century, I wouldn't disagree with a bit. And of course, the changing role of the corporation is a key element to all this, but it points out that because these are rapidly evolving situations, the flexibility is there to create locally the kind of institutions that can provide a more successful resolution without going to Congress, and in some cases without even approaching the state legislature. In separating out the subsistence right, at one of the points Doug Jones and John Havelock both brought up, Doug, in pointing out where I referred to the land, the claim settlement substituted land tenure and money for satisfying other aspects. I was thinking most strongly of subsistence there. I mean, that time, subsistence was important to a lot of us, but not nearly as important as it became in the next 10 years. So my view of it is very much colored by what went on in subsistence in the 70s, which you heard a lot about, but which was not where the trade-off was definitely made in order to get the bill. You couldn't open up that whole raft of legal arguments that exist in the United States on the control of living resources. And I think the decision was right to do it that way. I don't disagree with that particular decision, because it would have certainly brought in a whole new raft of dissident voices on the bill. So it's something that needs to be covered, as I said earlier, over the long term. And the other point that John made, individualism at the expense of group interests, I think that going back to the villages that we have established by saving the villages for the immediate and hopefully the distant future as viable social institutions, that we have established the framework where that kind of communality can continue to exist within the social framework of Alaska, irrespective of how much individualism pertains in the urban areas and how much of a dog-eat-dog situation pertains there. Hopefully the urban areas will change and become more communal in their outlooks on life as time goes by. I think I've covered most of the points that Doug brought up. A few happenstance was probably a bad choice of words, but I used it in the sense that everyone involved in developing the claim settlement were, you know, creatures of their legal environment at that time. You were working within the federal-state relationship, and so not having the time to the political power to broadly to broaden that relationship, why that's how I inserted that, but bad choice. Congress and its petard, I'll defend that. Congress was, I use that in the sense that since Congress is the parent of the Constitution, why it has developed the petards upon which it hangs itself, whether it's in handling discrimination between states or anything else. And I agree with you, I wouldn't particularly want a Congress which was able to discriminate strongly between states. I don't think most of us would have some problems dealing with that. And indeed, in Alaska, we sometimes feel that Congress discriminates against us in certain areas. If not Congress, at least the administration does. So, on federalizing, I didn't mean, and I went back and reread that, and I didn't really mean that we should seriously consider getting into refederalizing anything. It's one of the options that's been discussed strongly, but I think Bill Van Ness covered that about in the same manner I would have if I'd emphasized the point. I do believe the IRAs were written for the 1930s, and we can certainly do better now without getting into major legislative initiatives. On the point of a relatively irrevocable trust, I simply meant by that that legislative bodies have the means by which you can revoke trusts, and if the courts uphold them, why then the course to the trust is not irrevocable. You can, even a very strong enduring trust like the Bishop Trust in Hawaii is constantly subject to attacks on one means or another, but I think that strong trusts are a means of establishing enduring land patterns in Alaska, if in the Alaskan situation in many areas, if that's the desire of the landowners. On the LUPC, and I appreciated the kind words, and but the problem with the LUPC, Land Use Planning Commission, as the commissioners debated at great length whether to continue the commission, and the general consensus was at that time that special commissions should have a finite life, and that it was the job of the existing governments, the state and federal governments, to resume their obligation, any obligations which the commission was undertaking. And those recommendations were made to both, and don't see any signs of institutional development on the state side which is going to take the role of the commission yet in not resolving federal-state disputes, but in resolving disputes between state agencies, which, as Charlie pointed out, are probably affect most of the village corporations and any state landowner more than the federal agencies in most cases. Finally, I, like Bill Van Ness, have a very positive outlook on what's possible within the state. That certainly doesn't mean it's not going to it's going to happen without a great deal of hard work. But I don't believe that anything has happened up to now would keep us from working out a satisfactory future. And I still, after listening to my colleagues around the table, think the major responsibility is on the state government and state-created institutions to maintain that positivism and to maintain the relationships between all Alaskans to make things work out. And I think on that I will close, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Parker, could I just ask you one question? Mr. Jones said that subsistence was regarded by Congress in 1970-71 as not altogether a genuine plea for land to allow people to pursue traditional subsistence activities. He said it was one-third genuine and two-thirds, this was the view of congressmen, two-thirds a ruse to get more money. In the course of the Mackenzie Valley Pipeline inquiry, we had the same difficulty, that is, a refusal to take subsistence seriously, a refusal to believe that there really are people out there in rural Alaska or northern Canada, wherever it is, who go out and obtain their food from the land. And of course, it's a subject where it's a little difficult to get statistics that everybody accepts. It's often difficult to get any statistics. But you mentioned that subsistence had become an especial concern of yours in the 70s. Do you have any observation to make on what Mr. Jones said? Mr. Jones didn't say this was his view, but he attributed it to Congress. And what public attitudes are towards subsistence activities on the part of Alaska Natives? Not the kind of broad view of subsistence that I gather prevailed in 1982, but in that more limited sense.
The view of Alaskans in 1970 or...
Well, and then and now, if you are able to...
I think the problem is simply that at the Land Use Planning Commission, of course, had to handle subsistence as a major concern throughout its existence, and in its first public hearings was where it began to be established as an absolute major priority. Before then, the hearing record was certainly very eloquent on the needs of Alaska Native for wildlife, not simply for consumption, but for cultural maintenance, and Alaska Natives in the net land stated that very eloquently. So the material was there. What was missing and is that all those with interests in the Commonwealth, legal Commonwealth at that time, of Alaska fisheries and Alaska wildlife were simply taking adamant positions and going out across the country and, of course, recruiting their colleagues, and I mean by that people who were interested in fish and game management regarded subsistence at that time as anathema, and many of them still do. We've made some imprint there on the attitude of professional fish and game managers, but generally you would have expected to hear from that particular group. Guides, of course, regarded it as a threat in large, and then the urban hunting, and you know, it's all, the record is such a detailed one, and nobody was willing to take the time to sit down as Alaska Natives and the land did, and from then on, and go through it piece by piece, area by area. But that's the way, of course, we do fish and game regulations in Alaska, is one small piece of state of the state at a time. And the Congress, you know, it would have taken a great deal of time to totally educate the Congress on this particular issue, which not just because of the use of the consumption, which is very real, but also because of the relationship of wildlife to Alaska Native cultures and traditions, which we're all familiar with now. These things were not as widely known as they are in 1970, of course, but still, that's what I was getting at when I said we have to continue to develop sensitivity and linkages to get the true understanding of the importance of this to villages like Tununik, Point Hope, even the larger communities, Barrow, Bethel, all of them, you know, they, it is the understanding of the urban peoples is still not there as strongly as it should be. And, you know, that is a critical education job, which I regard the state as having some responsibility for.
Comment on this. I think there are lots of memories on this subject, and everyone looks at it a little differently, but there's a grain of truth in just about what everyone has said here from my memory. And I did, in 1966-67, a statewide study involving hundreds of Native Alaskans on the subsistence issue, and I came up, and an Alaska Natives in the Land was 60 million acres of subsistence land. And if you'll recall, in S-1830, the Senate version, there was a classification system for subsistence. In other words, all public lands that would remain in the federal government's terms would be classified with a subsistence priority around each village. Now, that when that got into the dialogue between the House and the Senate, that fell out. And I think in that context, Doug's comment about the relative importance may be right on from the Washington perspective. In addition, I remember one Sunday morning getting a call very early morning on Sunday from Willie Hensley. I said, my God, those guys have not gone to bed yet. And the AFN was meeting on a Sunday morning, and they asked me to come down. They were going down to Washington in a couple of days. Some further hearings and so on, and they were in this throes of changing from the 20 million to the 40 million, if my memory is correct on that. And and I said, for God's sakes, if you're going to base any of this on subsistence, go for 60. And of course, it never got really articulated that was the real, or as close as anybody had been able to figure it, land base of actual use and occupancy. It would be, it has not been done in this state on any statewide basis, any real appraisal of what subsistence lands are needed. We've done bits and pieces of it. In the Arctic villages, Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, there's a very finite inventory that took place in the planning process over 4 years, Joe, wasn't it, at least, of village meeting after village meeting over a period of 4 years, in which all the elders and all of the folks involved put down in detail where the hell their sled tracks were. And that has not been done as widely across the state as it would be necessary to really examine the subsistence issue closely again. But I think there was a big slippage in the House-Senate compromise when the subsistence classification around villages was allowed to go by.
Yes, Mr. Parker.
Just to follow up a little bit on that, when I was on the Board of Fish and Game, why at that time, you know, the issue was before us all the time in the early 70s, and the boards of that period were adamant that they wouldn't even consider a concept such as subsistence areas. And after I left the board and was with the commission, I had two commissioners to work with, and I wasn't able to move either one of those even an inch towards, really, even though after we got the state subsistence legislation passed and got a subsistence division created, getting that simple concept that, you know, of a subsistence area created has run into extremely strong opposition. And that's why I keep emphasizing that, building sensitivity to the reality of this as local needs and the rights of local protection is not something that's going to be achieved easily, but I think we have made some headway. I think that attitudes in major urban areas, while they wouldn't appear to have changed, if you listen to some spokesmen, if you were to get into some reasonable surveys, there would have been changes since the early 70s. So it's one of the reasons why I'm somewhat more positive than others may be on these things.
Yes, sir.
Go and recognize someone else, that's okay.
Yes, I will then. Mr. Peterson, Frank Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I guess I need to say, as I'm sure has been said before, as you started this conference, that I'd like to express the appreciation to the Inuit Circumpolar Conference Group and the World Council of Indigenous People in sponsoring this conference, this hearings. Individually, I serve as the president of our village corporation called Iakulik right now. I'm a current director of our regional corporation in Koniag. I also have served as a tribal president for one of our villages. As I've been listening to a lot of these comments here, many questions have been coming out, and I'm trying to understand the purpose of this Alaska Native Review Commission, and as you state, to do an independent assessment of what's happening in Alaska to indigenous people. It's an international effort. What are the, to assess the effects of ANCSA, what has happened since 1971, recommendations will be made for the future of Alaska Natives, etc. Now, I do have some strong feelings about what has transpired to date since 1971. I have served in Washington along with Guy Martin in Congressman Baggage's office as an intern. So I was able to observe the activities pertaining to the Claims Act during that time. Just a note here before I forget it. You know, it's very interesting to hear all of these comments. People like Van Ness, who's been directly involved, Doug Jones and Guy Martin, John Havelock. But I would hope and urge the commission that as you travel to the villages that you pay as much attention to the comments that they will be making out there as you have here. Know that you have professionally done papers here that are going to have an impact, I'm sure, on the results of this study and the conclusions that you're going to be drawing based on these kinds of comments, as say compared to the comments you're going to receive from the villages. As we started this hearing this morning, one of my first notations that I made was immediate reaction. ANCSA, as pertains to Alaska Natives, is a farce, you know, because as I look back, how much land has the Native communities or Native people actually gotten to date? Okay, it was commented earlier that land is not accruing to individual Natives. That is true, very true. As to the amount of money that is being referred to as $962.5 million, I think I've added up a total of $6,000, plus or minus, that individual Native people have accrued as a result of the Claims Act. So in that sense, it is a farce. I've heard comments such as landmark achievements. Heard comments about Claims Act being a very successful legislation. But in terms of the individual Native person, I would have to contradict that. I don't think it's been very successful. All one needs to do at present is look at the 200 and some annual reports that are required to be submitted. Take a look at the 12 regional annual reports I think it was Mr. Van Ness who said that there's no documentation now similar to the Alaska Natives in the land that would indicate any progress as a result of the Claims Act. Well, take a look at some of the annual reports. And I think in the Western society, as far as profitability, one looks for the bottom line, profit or loss. I think if you look at the status of each of these 200 or so corporations today, you'll find a dismal failure in this concept and experiment called the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. I need to say these things because they're bothering me. I'm sure they're bothering a lot of people who may be listening or who are going to be reviewing the results of this hearing. There are a lot of questions that I have that are coming up that are not properly formulated yet, but I think as the commission travels to the villages, you're going to be hearing some very strong comments about the pros and cons of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. One additional comment I'd like to make is with regard to what Mr. Van Ness and Mr. Parker has said about the IRA Act being a product of the 1930s, you know, I grant you that. It is a piece of legislation that was written back then, but as far as the application of that law here in the state of Alaska, among our village communities to date, that law has not been given the opportunity to work. People have not been given the chance to make that law work. I think if we were to reassess the practicality of the Indian Reorganization Act as it pertains to Alaska, I think that may be the best possible way to implement a piece of legislation similar to ANCSA, because first place it is a form of government which can provide services to the people that we refer to in the Claims Act in a certain section of it. Also, as it pertains to the profitability of a corporation, it provides for a federal charter in that act for village communities or tribes to get involved in profit activities. So I must disagree with your statements that the IRA Act is not workable in Alaska. I think I need to say that it needs to be given a chance to work before it is completely condemned. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Well, it certainly gives us two views of the Claims Act here today. Mr. Havelock and then Mr. Havelock, you want
to. Thank you. Yeah, some of these things tend to get lost, so I know you've got other speakers you want to get on, but I'll not remember some of these things later on. I guess whether it's a dismal failure, as Frank said, or a great success may depend in part on whether you come from a village or whether you come from Washington, D.C. I did not want to let go Doug's remark that, which has been touched on by others, that subsistence was viewed as an adroit vehicle and as at least it certainly wasn't some sort of a scheme on the part of native interests and certainly wasn't seen by those of us in state government as anything like that, nor was it seen that way by the commission. As Dave Hickok has pointed out, the 60 million, in fact at some point 90 million acres as I remember, was talked about as the subsistence framework for Alaska Natives. And once that number was out, of course, it did become useful to use that to see what else you could get in terms of the economic settlement, because the problem with the with those larger numbers was that all they were going to do is give a trust beneficiary's interest in the land, and you get the right to hunt and fish and gather on it, but you weren't going to get a dime's worth of any other estate in it. Bill commented in beginning his remarks, Mr. Van Ness, that measured as radical social engineering, it was a success. And that brought to mind immediately what Fred Paul had said over and over during the settlement, Joe Upixon and others, that who insisted that this was to be a settlement of a legal claim, and we should understand it as a settlement of a legal claim, because they understood from their past experience that if we started to treat it as broad social legislation, that it was going to be, as has in some senses been implied in what's been said here, some kind of a termination act, that is, that would absolve the federal government of any further responsibility for the social and health and other purposes of Native peoples and other responsibilities. Viewing it as a legal claim, though, did have its deficits in the sense that it tended to bring more of a focus on the quantitative aspects of it. I mean, how many hours and days were spent talking about numbers of acres, numbers of dollars, and there, and relative to that, the qualitative aspects of the settlement, including the system of corporations and so on, was relatively neglected, even though it was discussed. And it seems to me that Mr. Peterson's point with respect to the failure comes home with respect to that social engineering aspect, which was inevitably in it. That is, from the point of view of Alaska Natives, there was certainly a settlement of a claim, but from the point of view of the Congress, the point of view of Alaskan state institutional interest, it was indeed some kind of a social settlement also. And there was great concern on the part of the governor and the part of others that the vehicle was going to deprive us some of the major aspects of social justice, if you will, that needed to be addressed. That is, the background to the adoption of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was in part the courageous and ultimately united push of Alaska Natives for their settlement, but the other part of it was the Congress, which you may remember in that era, was aroused by the picture of poverty in rural Alaska, and by poverty generally in the United States. A corporate form didn't really address that, and I think that Mr. Peterson is quite correct in identifying the impact of the settlement with respect to the average village dweller. Let's face it, the corporate form is basically an institution for trickle-down economics. It puts the major resources in the hands of impersonal institutions whose major beneficiaries, and I'm not knocking it, are frankly those that draw salaries, those that are responsible for the administration of the act, not the ultimate people who are supposed to be the beneficiaries, the individuals that lived in the village. And what the act did from a social engineering point, Mr. Van Ness, was to take a people who were in some senses united by their poverty and spread them out over the spectrum of economic advantage, which is that which you find in the rest of the economy. The last point I want to make with Bill made a point about being politically realistic. And I certainly agree with that and what Doug said, that you shouldn't go any further than you have to in addressing the structural issues. But I would also say that political realism needs to be balanced with a valid assessment of your own actual needs and what you really need. Lowered expectations, which is in some senses what is being suggested, is a self-fulfilling prophecy. There would not have been an Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act if had not been stimulated expectations among the Alaska Native people. I think that there will be, Bill very, I seemed astutely, pointed out to me some of the congressional windows through which action can come. I'm a little apprehensive about the Arctic Wildlife Refuge one because you'd have to figure what the cost is with respect to, if that legislation goes through, there'll be oil company objectives being fulfilled as well as Alaska Native ones, then you're going to have to live with those. Certainly the 85 review seems to me is a good window. And when I think, as he says, about the changing guard in Washington, D.C., whether or not Ted Stevens is there in 1991, I remember who was there in 1969, 1968. Before the act, I don't remember him taking a terribly strong role, but I do remember Ted Kennedy taking a very strong leadership role. I don't think the act could have happened without the support of Kennedy, and I think looking at it strictly on longevity tables, Ted Kennedy is going to be there. And if you come in, as Bill says, with united positions, you're going to be have an audience in Ted Kennedy, and I doubt very much that he's going to be a nondescript sort of senator at that time.
Well, I said we had had two views of the Claims Act. I think Mr. Havelock has offered us a third, if I may say so. Maybe we could invite one or two others in the time that we have left this afternoon. I was going to call on Mr. Borbridge, who, by the way, Mr. Hickok, don't let me detain you, but Mr. Borbridge made the point yesterday that you made, that the Senate version gave preference to subsistence and it got lost in the works. Yes, Mr. Borbridge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Hickok yielded the balance of his time to me. Mr. Chairman, I want to hit some of the background of the Settlement Act just briefly, because we have talked, I think, without a fuller discussion of several matters that I think, from the viewpoint of the Native people, need a little more elaboration. I think, in my opinion, there has been confusion with respect to the term sovereignty, because we have used it in two senses. We have talked about it in terms of who, which governmental entity exercises the supreme power, which is the highest, the most powerful, or the strongest. It really has not been discussed by people who were with government in terms of how it relates to the Indian or Native tribes. Before doing that, I wanted to touch just briefly on this matter of the legal status of the Alaska Natives. The federal government owes the Native Americans, of whom the Alaska Natives are a part, the obligation of its trusteeship, not because of our poverty or the government's wrongdoing in the past, but because within the federal system, the government's relationship with the Native Americans are of the highest legal standing, established through solemn treaties and a series of judicial decisions and legislative actions. Thus, the treaties negotiated with Indian tribes in which the United States acquired vast areas of land in exchange for its solemn commitment to protect the members of the tribes and their properties from encroachment by U.S. citizens is one origin of this trust relationship. Likewise, statutory enactment dating from the Continental Congress to the present, regulating transactions between U.S. citizens and members of the Indian tribes, is again another place from which trusteeship was developed. Innumerable transactions in which, in the latter part of the 19th century, the United States imposed a complex and vast array of regulatory authority over Indians and their property, along, coincident with its assumption of control over the people and property of the Indian tribes. It's not to get off on something that is totally disassociated from what we are discussing, but I do want to emphasize that, again, the history of the Indian tribes, of which we Alaska Natives are definitely a part, of this entire, not only United States, but we see ourselves as coming from the Native Americans. The origin of those tribes preceded, antedated the formation of this country. And thus, when we talk from whence came the tribes, we must likewise look back to the same ancient beginnings when we ask from whence is derived sovereignty which is exercised by those tribes. We all appreciate, not being an attorney, I only try to go through a non-technical approach and appreciate that sovereignty is a characteristic of a body that is able to accomplish certain things, and that in our system of government, as we have different levels of government, so we have different levels and types of sovereignty that are exercised, but that those largely are types of sovereignty that are delegated. With respect to the Indian tribes, their sovereignty is derived from their origin and their beginnings as Indian tribes, when first they were dealt with as independent nations through treaties, and then later with the abandonment of treaties beginning in 1871 with executive agreements, and likewise in the law with the change from independent sovereign nations to that status of dependent nations. I state this because all of this, in a fashion that is beginning to emerge from rural Alaska in a much more meaningful, less theoretical sense, has to be viewed as the background and is the context within which it appears we are going to be functioning as we come to consider some very practical, precise amendments or methods of improvement of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Thus, in a very broad scoped way, firstly, I was very pleased with Mr. Van Ness's comment, because the Claims Settlement Act and the thrust for a settlement, the assertion of the land rights of the Native people, began because the Native people began. In effect, was sort of a compromise between, on the one hand, ancient Native land rights, whose origins are traced through the historic factors that I have mentioned, and which land rights were spelled out in the use and occupancy of the lands by the Natives since time immemorial. These rights collided with the institutionalized views of the members of Congress, who had their perceptions of what land meant. In many instances, it meant something that was quantifiable. It was an economic asset. It had maximum or optimum value when disposed of on the marketplace at the right time, as we follow the chart of how these things went. Well, all of this, the rights and the feelings of the Native people came against and was considered within the institutionalized views of Congress, seeing this in somewhat different terms, and plus the collision with a state that viewed the assertion of Native land rights as a threat to their selection rights under the state constitution. The Natives recognized that Congress would ultimately determine the terms and shape of a land claims settlement. The Native people came to the negotiating table with their tribal identity and with their expectations, many of which were shaped by their culture. In negotiating, the Native representatives realized that they weren't able to get everything. Sometimes it was necessary to compromise on something to get it through. And as Mr. Van Ness indicated, we were successful in many of those efforts. the native people, when they first went to Washington, D.C., while we talk about some very sophisticated views that we advanced, began by explaining what Alaska Indians, Alaska Eskimos, and Alaska Aleuts are, and where do we live, and are we all frozen? And forgive me, Joe, but do we all live up on the North Slope? And do we always have snow there? And how can you live on it? And so we, as we began to try to explain these things, we took this traditional form, we talked with our advisors, and we began to realize from our attorneys that we had to translate this into Indian title so that we could assert it as a right. We viewed it as a right because we were, through the people who were in the villages, we were on the land. The land rights had not been extinguished. And it was important to us as a matter of pride, not only for ourselves, but those who would likewise enjoy whatever benefits might be derived from ANCSA, because, again, we wanted to be sure that all people, Alaskans as well as those in Congress, view this as an assertion of land rights and not our seeking of a handout. So these ancient rights were translated into the specialized concept that arises out of Indian law, Aboriginal rights, or Indian title. And we presented this to Congress. Congress began to say to us, the members, that we are not actually negotiating. Now, this time they did use sovereign. We are the sovereign, and we determine. Well, we resisted that as very vigorously, and I think very effectively. It's hard to measure at this point, given all of this background, the strength and the vigor of the current movement today in 1984 as it relates to this sense of tribalism, this sense of a desire to exercise sovereignty, the recognition that tribalism, the existence of a tribe, is dependent to a large extent, although not solely, on a land base. Thus, as I look at our expectations back in 71, we were impelled by a sense of urgency, of crisis, of land losses that were being incurred or had been incurred by state selections. I haven't had the opportunity to state further that there certainly was a partnership of effort at various points with the state of Alaska. However, the Alaska Natives had to drag the state into a partnership with us, kicking and screaming. The state had initiated the suit Alaska versus Udall, and here, this frankly isn't so much for your benefit, all of you know this, but I think there are other people, Alaska Natives, who are dealing with some of the matters to which I alluded, who I hope will look carefully back to the history of ANCSA, not only with respect to provisions, but how things were accomplished, so that they can suit this and perhaps even improve on how they intend to deal with the improvement of ANCSA, and for that matter, with the steps toward the formalization, the revitalization of their tribal governments, if this is what the people should determine they desire, and the exercise of sovereignty incident to that status. And all I wanted to say was that on several occasions, we had not only a suit by the state of Alaska, which was intended to break the land freeze on which the natives triumphed. Likewise, the state of Alaska challenged the basis for a 2% overriding royalty worth $500 million. And again, the natives prevailed. The point being that it was possible for us, as we did, to be on the one hand partners with the state because on a number of occasions and as to a number of provisions, the state of Alaska did work closely with us where we sought a commonality of interest. And at the same time, we were adversary on certain of the points. Likewise, too, Chairman Aspinall, following passage of the Act, sponsored a proposed amendment to ANCSA, which ostensibly was intended to cure technical defects. In the viewpoint of the natives, it was addressing substantive issues, and with some help from congressional friends, we had it killed. I guess what I'm saying essentially is that it's possible in the process of Native people seeking the kind of objectives that we had in mind when we sought the enactment of ANCSA to encounter some of the most powerful, sophisticated opposition, and with the aid of friends and others sympathetically inclined with our views, to still triumph over those. I guess all I'm saying, Mr. Chairman, is on the one hand, there was a land claim because the Native people began to assert their rights. After we asserted it, you social scientists, engineers, had a crack at it. But you didn't have a crack at anything until we got the ball rolling. Then at that point, we began to get input. And all I want am emphasizing again is that what we see with respect to the desire to revitalize tribal bodies, exercise sovereignty, has a dignified history that precedes the formation of our country. And when we see it happening today, whatever we may incline toward the improvement of ANCSA, and I agree with Mr. Peterson, it needs improvement. I have more gray hairs than him, and I expect him to accomplish this. And I appreciate Mr. Van Ness's approach because I think ultimately that's where we're going to end up. Specifically, what can we accomplish? But all of this has a context of things that are happening in rural Alaska. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Borbridge. Might I suggest how we proceed now? We have been adjourning here about 4:15 or 4:30. This is the bingo hall, and the tables are needed for bingo, which commences within an hour or two, I gather. And it makes just about a long enough day, I think. But perhaps I might make one or two suggestions about tomorrow. First of all, perhaps we could try to convene again about 9:15 a.m. Then maybe you might allow me to call on those and I apologize to all three of you gentlemen that I haven't reached you yet, Mr. Hope and Mr. Starr and Mr. Paul, to offer their thoughts and to ask some pointed questions of our panel of experts. Mr. Peterson, if you have further questions, we might we'll reach them then. And Mr. Malott and Mr. Johnson, of course, if you have further thoughts, we'll want to hear from you, and of course from Mr. Upixson. Could I just say before we adjourn, Mr. Peterson said he hoped this commission would pay as much attention to what people in the villages say as we're paying to this group of people, notable people assembled here this week and next week and the week after. Yes, we are. In fact, Don Mitchell suggested that this commission should hear from the experts, if all of you are willing to accept that designation, and then go to the villages and hear what people had to say. And so that's what we intend to do. We've already been to two villages, but we expect to go to many more after these 3 weeks of overview sessions are over. Mr. Borbridge just alluded to something that keeps coming up, and I think it would be a mistake to try to ignore it. Mr. Borbidge said yesterday that he thought sovereignty would be the issue of the 80s. Mr. Jones put exactly the opposite case. He said, well, we don't need any governments that are ethnically or racially defined. We don't want anything that smacks of the reservation system of the lower 48. Government is public government, and everyone shares equally in that government. It applies to all. And that's a view that you find in the United States. You find it in Canada. In Canada, people say, well, why can't we all be Canadians together? You know, my father came from Ireland, and he did this, and he did that, and now we're all equal as Canadians. And I'm sure this is what you've heard a thousand times over. But in Canada, an all-party committee of the House of Commons last November, representing all parties, unanimously decided that the native people of Canada should be recognized as a third order of government. We have the federal government, the provinces, which are the equivalent of the states, and they said a third order of government, native governments. And now, whether that it will ultimately find its way into legislation remains to be seen, but it certainly is an expression of, or a commitment in a broadest sense by all the political parties. Now, here in Alaska, people keep saying, perhaps they shouldn't be saying it, perhaps the idea has no future, but they keep saying, we want our own government. They're talking about political institutions that have certain powers to regulate their own affairs, certain powers of taxation, and so on. Mr. Johnson said, well, perhaps we can achieve those same objectives through ANCSA, through an astute use of the powers we already have, an astute use of the influence we have. Perhaps we can ensure that our people are free to make the choices that seem important to them out in the villages. That's another view. But perhaps some of you who have considered this and know, I suppose, of the opposition that such a notion might attract in Congress or among the general public, might just consider it. It might as well be faced. It seems to me that some people, Mr. Borbidge, when you talk about tribal government, you're talking about a political institution in which Native people participate, and that, in a sense, has a government-to-government relationship with the federal government and the states. And that is what President Reagan said in his statement in January last year. He said, we recognize the sovereignty of Indian governments, and we acknowledge that we deal with them on a government-to-government basis. Now, has that notion got a future? If it has a future in the lower 48, is it something that will get nowhere in Alaska? Maybe tomorrow, and I hope we can, I know you're all busy, but those of you from out of town have not quite as good an excuse as others for not being here, but I know some of you can't be here the whole time, but you might take a kick at that. And tomorrow, Mr. Hope, Mr. Starr, and Mr. Paul, I promise that we'll get to you right away. But we did have these distinguished people here, and I thought we should call them. Mr. Hope?
Well,
I think you look just fine. So could we try for 9:15 and see how it goes?